they will introduce Tobias.
Thanks, sorry. Good morning, everybody. I'm not going to do karaoke on what you can read yourself about Tobias's introduction in the program, but I would like to say a few personal words about my encounter with Tobias. Last year is 2016 in the springtime. I went to Helsinki for a workshop that was being put on by a Nordic Center of Excellence there. In one of the first conferences or seminars I ever saw held on critical race theory in the Nordic context. And it was there I first encountered Tobias Hübinette, who will deliver our keynote today. And the thing that was interesting to me then is, and now, is that he's leading in Sweden and founded and leading the network on, I want to get this part right because this is not karaoke, this is important. The Swedish Research Network for Critical Race and Whiteness Studies. And basically why it was important is I was waiting 2 decades for that kind of conversation that I saw in Helsinki last spring. And I'm wondering, okay, why did it take us so long to get around to talking about issues that maybe 2 decades ago were emergent, we could see them already, but why did it take us so long to do that? And again, even to say a little bit more personal about Tobias here, he had a keynote to deliver this morning, which is a very important message, but he took the time out yesterday to be discussing in the panel that we ran and pulled together a lot of very loose threads in a session we had yesterday afternoon. And I thought that it was incredibly generous of him and in a very humble way that I thought was just, it speaks to a very special kind of scholar that we don't have enough of in probably the Nordic region. And when it came time to inviting keynotes to this conference, I felt rather strongly that this would be a really nice scholar from close by, not far away, not from some different continent, to tell us Nordic people what we could be thinking about instead of what we think we should be thinking about, but instead do a little bit of possibility thinking along the lines of the issues of why we're here to discuss race, powers, and mobility. So without that, you did not come here to listen to me to talk this morning. I would like to introduce Tobias Hübinette and give the floor to you.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much, David, for your kind words, and thanks also for all the organizers of this conference. And I will read from a text, basically, and I think it will take about 40, 45 minutes or so. The sound. Yes, maybe. Yes. Maybe the volume. Now? Yeah. It's better?
Is it better?
Okay. I will try to speak a bit loud as well. Okay, so I start out by with this first slide. It is a well-known fact that Sweden tops the international rankings, lists, and comparisons as having the most progressive multiculturalist and integrationist policy, and the most thorough anti-discrimination and anti-racist legislation in the world, as well as harboring the most tolerant, open-minded, and anti-racist majority population on Earth, without any competition. Concerning the other Nordic countries, Finland and Norway also usually receive top positions when it comes to at least integration policy rankings, while Denmark and Iceland have chosen a so-called tougher anti-multiculturalist stance towards immigrants and minorities, according to, for example, the widely cited and also respected MIPEX index, which is funded by the EU. However, when it comes to the majority population's attitudes, the majority Norwegians, the majority Finns, and the majority Danes, and most probably also the majority Icelanders, express much less favorable opinions on immigrants and minorities than the majority Swedes. And this particular Swedish exceptionalism has also become more and more pronounced within the Nordic region during recent years in numerous opinion polls on based on questionnaires that have been conducted in the Nordic region throughout Europe and sometimes also in the whole Western world. For example, during the so-called refugee crisis year of 2015, the Swedes were actually the only EU population who was in favor of specifically non-European immigration and non-European or non-Western immigrants. During that year, when Sweden took in more non-European immigrants than any other Western country per head, as many as 77% of the Swedes stated that they were in favor of non-European immigration and non-European immigrants, while no other EU population in any EU member state reached over 50%, and Spain and Croatia came second after Sweden with a mere 48%, and the EU average stood at 36%, and many EU countries' results were actually below 20%. This, in a both pan-Nordic, pan-European, and pan-Western perspective, absolutely unique and specific Swedish relationship to the non-Western world, to the former colonies in the global south and the third world, and to people of color and non-white immigrants and minorities in general, which goes back to the end of the 1960s, makes Sweden and the Swedes different from the other Nordic countries and peoples, which are more like other European and Western nations and populations when it comes to harboring neutral, negative, and sometimes even hostile and hateful attitudes and opinions on non-European immigration and on non-European immigrants. However, before the end of the 1960s, Sweden had been one of the Western countries which had been most heavily invested in race during its high modernity nation-building process that took place roughly around 1900 to 1965, when the Swedish academia, for example, excelled in so-called race science, and when the Swedes, together with the Norwegians, the Danes, and the Swedish-speaking Finns, were bestowed with the absolutely privileged position of being seen as the whitest of all whites, as they constituted the so-called Nordic race, which was seen as the genetic and aesthetic elite of humankind. In 1930, for example, at the International Stockholm Exhibition, which marked the proud entrance of Sweden on the world stage as being the most rational and scientific so-called third way or Swedish or Nordic model nation in the world, the Swedes were presented as being the whitest of all whites in one of the most centrally placed and biggest exhibition halls in Stockholm, showing the results of the body measurements of tens of thousands of Swedes, which had been carried out by the Swedish race science scholars and the Race Biological Institute. This idea about the Nordic race also resulted in the exclusion of the Finnish-speaking Finns, as well as, of course, the Samis, from the heavily racialized Nordic community, and even, at least for a while, maybe even from whiteness itself. While it was Sweden that stood out in the Nordic region as being one of the countries in the Western world, I should say in the democratic Western world, where race thinking played a crucial role in the nation-building project, as well as in relation to the introduction and development of the Swedish welfare state during the first half of the 20th century, Norway also more or less followed the Swedish example after its independence in 1905, although to a lesser extent. An Icelandic nationalist claimed that Iceland also had a rightful place in the Nordic race community and thus deserved independence more than, for example, the non-white Greenlanders, while Finland had to fight for the country's inclusion into the white Nordic community after its independence in 1918. And again, through official information material and beauty pageants, among others, by again and again proving that the Finns were not any so-called semi-Mongols. And it was not until 1954 when Finland finally became fully integrated into the Nordic community on a legal and international relations level through the Nordic Passport Union that this goal was finally accomplished, when Sweden finally removed the last rules concerning Finnish immigrant citizenship rules in Sweden that had not been applicable to the other Nordic immigrants. Between around 1916 and 1968, Sweden also struck a demographic world record per head when it came to so-called negative race hygienic measures, including nearly 65,000 sterilizations that were performed between 1935 and 1975, an extremely efficient child institutionalization and foster care system which led to approximately 200,000 children being placed at institutions or in foster and adoptive families between 1920 and 1970, and tens of thousands of forced abortions which took place on so-called social indications, especially between the 1930s and 1950s. In a comparative international perspective, this racialized Swedish biopolitical population policy, which was institutionalized in the 1910s and 1920s and deinstitutionalized in the 1960s and 1970s, governed by the overarching idea and conviction that the Swedes were the purest of the most noble part of the white race as being the prime representative of the so-called Nordic race, is in many ways unique, as Sweden did not have any overseas colonies anymore during this time period. Therefore, it was the white Swedish majority population itself which was principally affected by the race hygienic measures, while the policy towards the national minorities was more characterized by either forced assimilation, and that was the travelers and the Finnish speakers, including the Tornedalians, or spatial segregation, that was the Roma people, or a mixture in between, and that was the Samis. In other words, while most other Western nations, and in particular the Western imperial powers and the white settler states of the time, focused on conquering and ruling over the others, the Swedish racial state was principally directed towards disciplining and purifying its own white population instead of concentrating solely, or at least mainly, on the minorities. This fact makes the Swedish high modernity racial state case a bit difficult to grasp and conceptualize, according to, for example, Etienne Balibar's division between external and internal races. It is true that the travelers and the Roma people were overrepresented with regards to the forced removal of children and various child welfare interventions, including institutionalization, adoption, and fostering. And it is also true that the other national minorities were, of course, negatively affected by this Swedish racialized population policy. However, except for the Finnish-speaking minority, the absolute number of all national minorities taken together was comparatively small during this time period, meaning that they could easily be contained and controlled and excluded and marginalized, as the Samis and the Tornedalians were concentrated to the northern part of the country, and the travelers and the Roma were forced to live in segregated settlements or to be vagrant well into the 1960s, thereby refusing them citizens' rights, such as access to education, voting, or social welfare services. Although the Swedish statistics are extreme when it comes to the various negative race hygienic measures, there are also similarities to Norway in terms of the harsh Norwegian minority policy towards its country's travelers and Samis, and to Finland when it comes to the high number of sterilizations that were performed during Finland's high modernity period. Finally, as late as the 1960s, the idea about the Nordic race and about the Swedes as being the prime example of the Nordic race and consequently of the white race and global whiteness itself was still strong within the Swedish academia, the Swedish elites, and the Swedish establishment. For example, between 1961 and 1965, a more or less continuous political debate took place in Sweden, mainly in the newspapers, among politicians, researchers, and various authorities regarding if Sweden would institutionalize the practice of transnational adoption or not. The old Swedish elite and establishment then stood in opposition to radical left-liberal journalists, celebrities, and activists, who were, of course, also much younger than the first camp. And the first camp continued to argue according to the same racial logics like before, using a racialized rhetoric that had been commonplace since the 1910s, while arguing that the white Swedes, belonging to the Nordic race, would not benefit from the adoption of children of color from the third world, as the children as adults would most probably reproduce with white Swedes. And racial miscegenation was always said to be negative for the white counterpart, as well as for the mixed race children themselves. The second camp, the left liberal camp, instead used the radical anti-racist language by arguing that Sweden was one of the Western world's most racially homogeneous countries in the 1960s, and that the Swedes in general harbored strong racial prejudices, even compared to other Western nations, and there were some questionnaires that proved that, actually, in the 1960s. And therefore, the bringing in of non-white children from the former colonies who would permanently settle and live in the country as adults would change that situation for the better. In hindsight, this debate can both be seen as the first Swedish articulation of the particular Swedish anti-racism that was to become hegemonic during the following decades, and as a watershed, not just in Sweden, but, yeah, maybe these are too strong words, but perhaps in the whole West when it came to formulating a wholly new and revolutionary white view on non-white people, on interracial intimacy, and on what later would develop into what we today know as colorblindness. So from the end of the 1960s, Sweden's relationship to race changed completely and almost overnight. And in 1966, Sweden was one of the world's first 10 sovereign nation states, together with, for example, the Soviet Union, Israel, and Poland, to sign and ratify the UN International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, which is, of course, the foundational text of modern anti-racism as we know of it today, and which at that time was widely seen in and by the Western nations as a radical anti-colonial and even anti-Western document stemming from the newly independent former European colonies in the Third World, which in the 1960s had completely turned the table around within the UN structure, where they now, taken together, made up the absolute majority of the UN's member states, where they also almost always were backed up by the Soviet-led communist bloc and by the Kingdom of Sweden, which started to vote for, and together with the Global South, already from the 1960s and onwards, and oftentimes against the more powerful Western nations. Furthermore, in 1975, Sweden was the second state in the world after Canada, which declared itself to be a multicultural nation and society, and which introduced multiculturalism as one of its state ideologies, together with feminism. Maybe you don't know that, but Sweden was the first country in the world to introduce a gender equality policy 2 years before, and that's in 1973, as well as a whole series of, at that time, extremely progressive and radical pro-minority laws, including home language education, simplified citizenship rules, and the right to vote in the local and regional elections for all inhabitants of Sweden, regardless of citizenship. Canada had declared itself to be multicultural in 1971, and thus, for sure, preceded Sweden with 4 years. But as Canada's decision was about keeping the North American and British Empire settler state together, which was on the verge of being split up between the white Anglophone and the white Francophone settler populations, and not about, for example, giving in to the country's First Nations. The comparison between Sweden and Canada is perhaps neither valid nor fair, as the Swedish multiculturalist regime that was introduced in 1975 was solely focused on the immigrants and the minorities. In 1975, Canada had also hardly left its white immigration policy, favoring white immigrants by the way of so-called race quotas. So, in other words, I think it is fair to argue that Sweden entered a new phase in its nation-building process after the end of the 1960s, which in time made the country different from practically all other white Christian Western countries, including its Nordic neighbors, as Sweden from that time started to side with the third world and also with minorities living permanently in the West, such as the African Americans. And thus, on a symbolic level, Sweden actually departed from the rest of the West on a political and above all on a racial level from the 1960s and onwards. Due to this unique Swedish Sonderväg when it comes to race, already from the end of the 1970s and even more in the 1980s and 1990s, Sweden became the Western country that took in proportionally the highest numbers of refugees and immigrants, including also adopted children, from the non-Western world and the former colonies, and even higher numbers per head than, for example, France, the UK, the Netherlands, Italy, Belgium, Portugal, and Spain, which all once had vast global colonial empires, and which all also experienced a huge inflow of former colonial subjects during the post-war period. As much as Sweden had played an absolutely fundamental part when it came to race science before the 1960s, Sweden now again played an equally, if not even more important role by creating a new anti-racist and post-colonial whiteness ready for a future when white supremacy and Western hegemony on a global level was soon to be over and for once and for all, and which in the 1970s must be said to have been extremely avant-gardistic and also almost prophetic, given how the world looks like today. Finally, in 2001, Sweden became the first sovereign nation state in the world to formally, officially, and legally abolish the concept of race. And since 2014, and at least until the next year, when the new election takes place in Sweden, the country is also ruled by the world's first and still only self-declared anti-racist government, at least in a democracy, as well as the world's first and still only feminist government, and again, at least in a democratic country. Anti-racism, including the abolishment of race, is today also an integrated part of Sweden's foreign policy together with feminism. And so far, Sweden has managed to influence and persuade both Norway and Finland to follow the Swedish example and to do away with the concept of race, although both the United Nations, the European Union, the Council of Europe, and countless other NGOs, as well as representatives from various minority groups, have criticized Sweden harshly for this radical anti-racist or post-racial or rather perhaps anti-racial decision, which seems to be a somewhat unique example of what David Theo Goldberg would call anti-racialism. That is, a reluctance, a resistance, or even a hatred towards the word race itself, including all its possible linguistic variations. However, recently and rapidly, and to the shock and dismay of the Swedes, as well as of the outside world, which often imagines Sweden and the other Nordic countries as something of the left-liberal paradise on earth, Sweden has become one of the most segregated, stratified, and segmented societies along racial lines in the Western world, and particularly in respect of the situations on the labor market, within the residential sector, and within the educational sphere. This also concerns the other Nordic countries, which are also showing similar outcome results when it comes to, for example, the unemployment rates among inhabitants with a non-Western background, although they are not yet on the same extreme levels as the ones in Sweden, which stands out both in the Nordic region and in the West as a whole. It is, for example, a statistical fact that the disparity and difference between native and foreign-born inhabitants in Sweden when it comes to being employed or not is by far the highest among all Western and even OECD or industrialized and developed countries. And this has been the case for the last decade or so. And it almost solely concerns non-Western immigrants and their children or descendants. While at the moment, around 2% of the majority Swedes are unemployed, over 30% of the inhabitants with an African and Asian background are currently unemployed, and less than half of them are in practice even active within the Swedish working life at all, while both the male and the female majority Swedes have the highest labor participation rates in the world, and perhaps even in world history at the moment, as they more or less work themselves to death. Although the situation for high-skilled foreign-born inhabitants in Finland and for low-skilled foreign-born inhabitants in Denmark is also severe and bad, it is still not as extreme as the situation for the inhabitants with a non-Western background in Sweden, and whether they are high-skilled or low-skilled. This Swedish almost astronomic disparity does not always have to do with differences in educational levels, as Sweden also seems to be one of the worst countries in Europe and in the West for particularly highly skilled immigrants with a non-Western background when it comes to the so-called overqualification problem. The callback ratio in situation testing studies also seems to be higher in Sweden than in most other Western countries, as well as the significance of certain variables and categories that might be at work when minority inhabitants in a certain country are discriminated against on the labor market and in other spheres of life, as the EU Commission's discrimination reports have indicated again and again. Although Sweden and Denmark are both the top EU member states when it comes to the variable or category of religion as well as looks, when it comes to the variable religion, variable looks seem to matter a lot, both in Sweden, Denmark, and Finland. While on the other hand, name, accent, and religion seem to matter much less in Finland compared to most other EU countries, and I don't know why. It's just interesting to note that in that respect, Finnish population seems to be, I don't know what to call it, tolerant or open-minded. To continue, when it comes to residential segregation, Sweden's big urban regions and middle-sized cities stand out in comparison with almost all other Western cities as having perhaps the most extreme racial segregation pattern in the OECD. And the segregation pattern is therefore much more extreme in Sweden than in the other Nordic countries, which, as far as I know, still do not have any, or as in the case of Sweden, several or actually many neighborhoods where over 90% of all inhabitants are minority inhabitants and mainly of a non-Western background. Already at the end of the 1990s, the OECD actually warned Sweden, and its government, of course, that its residential segregation rate, measured according to where the inhabitants with a non-Western background live and are concentrated, was escalating at a higher pace than in most other Western countries, and that it might even threaten the future of Sweden. There are, for example, indications that Sweden's three big city regions of Greater Stockholm, Greater Gothenburg, and Greater Malmö are, together with a handful of big cities in the US and perhaps three or four big cities in Central and Eastern Europe, the most racially segregated urban regions in today's Western world. Furthermore, this massively racialized segregation and stratification pattern in contemporary Sweden also unfortunately seems to be transferred to and inherited by the children of immigrants, the so-called second generation, who were born in and grew up in Sweden, and whose school results and educational attainment levels and poverty rates sometimes even exceed those of the so-called first generation, those of foreign-born themselves. While the second generation of the Nordic immigrants in Sweden are nowadays well on par with the majority Swedes in terms of employment rates, patterns of living, and income and wealth levels, even if the vast majority of the Finnish, the Danish, the Norwegian, and also the Icelandic post-war immigrants to Sweden were working class, or at least lower middle class, when they arrived in Sweden in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, the second generation of the non-Western immigrants, among whom a majority most probably belong to at least the middle class and sometimes even the upper middle class in their home countries in the former colonies, have in other words, for the most part, made a downhill socioeconomic journey. Recently, there are indications that inhabitants with a Nordic background have even started to show better outcome results than the majority Swedes themselves. And if that is the case, the story of the Nordic post-war immigrants and their children in Sweden must be said to be extraordinary, to say the least. At the same time, even non-white adoptees and mixed-race people born in Sweden with one parent from a non-Western country and one white parent are exposing lower levels of employment rates and higher poverty rates in spite of the fact that both the adopted and the mixed inhabitants of Sweden are in all respects ethnoculturally Swedish, and most of them also grew up among the more privileged socioeconomic strata of Swedish society. To make matters even worse, what is even more worrying is that all these heavily racialized disparities are becoming more and more extreme at the moment, and whether within working life, the educational field, or the residential sector. And this tendency is also similar, as far as I understood it, in the other Nordic countries. Although, once again, it seems that the Swedish statistics are much more extreme. And again, once again, belonging to some of the most extreme ones in the Western world when it comes to statistical outcome differences between the white majority population and the non-white minorities. Furthermore, continuing with all this bad news from contemporary and otherwise inherently anti-racist Sweden, a government report from 2013 focusing on the future of Sweden stated that 80% of all Swedes rarely or never socialize with people of a non-European or non-Western background outside of school and working life. And at the same time, 98.6% of all Swedes have nothing at all against having a neighbor with another racial background than themselves, according to the World Values Survey, which is by far the highest percentage in the world. Simultaneously, Emma Neumann has showed in her thesis that the Swedish white flight and white avoidance threshold is as low as 6 or 7%, and which might well be the lowest in the Western world at the moment, and meaning in practice that if the proportion of inhabitants with a non-Western background exceeds 6 or 7% in a certain neighborhood or perhaps even a block, majority Swedes will move out from or will also avoid moving into the very same neighborhood. And Jenny Castellanos has shown that similar low white flight and white avoidance levels also seem to exist within the Swedish educational sector and among schools. And especially in the big and the middle-sized cities of Sweden, where the racialized school segregation pattern is the most extreme. As already stated, in Finland and in the other Nordic countries, it seems that these worrying and perhaps even shocking Swedish statistical patterns and tendencies are similar, but not yet as extreme as in Sweden, and which may at least partly be explained by the fact that Sweden by far harbors the proportionally biggest population of inhabitants and minorities with a non-Western background compared to the other Nordic countries. Today, over 1 out of 3 of all 10 million inhabitants of Sweden have a foreign migrant or minority background, and over 1 out of 5 have a non-Western background, meaning that the racial diversity of today's Sweden is actually on par with Canada, Australia, the UK, France, the Netherlands, and Belgium, although not yet on the same level as the one in the US, which stands out in the whole Western world when it comes to its demographic racial heterogeneity, as we all know, and where white Americans are already below 50% among the younger cohorts. With this perhaps a too time-consuming and perhaps even too tedious historical contextualization, it would seem obvious and clear that also Sweden and the Nordic countries would need to start to reintroduce and research race as the Nordic countries are becoming racially diverse at a fast pace, and which not only has to do with the newly arrived non-Western refugees and immigrants anymore, but with the fact that the mean age of the majority population is increasingly higher, meaning that most of them are actually not able to reproduce today, while the mean age of the inhabitants with a non-Western background is very low, meaning that most of them are still in the reproductive age. In Sweden, for example, half of the majority Swedes are now about 45 years old, while over 90% of all immigrants with a non-Western background who have arrived into Sweden during the last 10 years are below 45 years old. In fact, within a decade or so, it is not just countries like Russia, Germany, Italy and Spain, and Greece, and Portugal, there are many actually, which will be so-called extremely aged societies, but also several, maybe even all of the Nordic countries. If only looking at the mean age of the majority population, and meaning that 1 out of 3 of the majority inhabitants in most Nordic countries, or even perhaps all, will be about 65 years old in the near future, while relatively small proportions of the same demographic subgroup will at the same time be between 0 or 45 years old. At the same time, Swedish and Nordic researchers in general are usually hesitant and sometimes even... I think I will skip something here. At the same time, Swedish and Nordic researchers in general are usually hesitant and sometimes even hostile towards introducing the concept of race and towards studying such urgent issues for Sweden and for the other Nordic countries, such as various levels and expressions of racial exploitation, racial stratification, racial discrimination, racial segregation, and racial hierarchization within various societal sectors and spheres, and not just the residential, educational, or labor markets, but also, for example, within the cultural sphere, within academia, in the world of business, and in everyday life, etc., etc., etc. And this also goes for Swedish and Nordic migration research. So why is the concept of race still generally avoided within Swedish and Nordic research? And which are the main arguments for and against the use of the concept of race within Swedish and Nordic academia? I have myself been involved in several quite heated and intense and sometimes, to be honest, aggressive debates and discussions, mainly within the Swedish academia and among Swedish researchers throughout the years, including in migration studies, and where most researchers implicitly or explicitly operationalize categories which are still quite strongly dichotomizing, which usually follow the official statistical categorization of the population in a certain country, and also still focus heavily on the foreign-born or first-generation or immigrant group. And they, most of them, not all of them, mainly in practice study Swedes and immigrants, Norwegians and immigrants, Finns and immigrants, and so on. Consequently, due to the strong focus on the migration aspect itself, and thus on the immigrants or the first-generation and the foreign-born, there are very few studies, although there are more studies coming, which include demographic minority subgroups, such as the so-called second generation, and the mixed and the adopted. And many studies do not differentiate between Western and non-Western immigrants and minorities. And very few studies write about and name their subjects, participants, respondents, and informants as white or non-white. And the vast majority prefers the concept of ethnicity. And the white majority population is almost always named as ethnic Swedes, ethnic Finns, ethnic Icelanders, and so on, and which outside the Nordic academia might sound very confusing. And in particular in the English-speaking world, where, for example, an ethnic Dane would mean a minority Dane of some sorts. In an article series about the concept of race, which I initiated in the biggest Swedish newspaper, Dagens Nyheter, in 2013, Richard Schulkin, for example, at Stockholm University, who is working within the field of migration studies, said that for him, it is enough to know the country of origin of his research subject, even if he is aware that it is necessary to make use of the concept of race, for example, in the US, as the marginalization of non-white Americans cannot be explained by the migration factor. Furthermore, in a 2014 issue of the Nordic Journal of Migration Research, and I think many of you are familiar with this debate, Annika Rabo, who also actually comes from Stockholm University and who works within migration studies, criticized and questioned the Danish researcher Rikke Andreasen's use of the concept of race in relation to Danish Muslims, as Rabo argued that race has nothing to do with Muslims. You can see the quote here. Several professors and senior researchers at the Department of Cultural Anthropology and Ethnology at Uppsala University and who work within migration studies also told me when I was invited to speak about Swedish race relations and Swedish whiteness at the department's higher seminar series barely a year ago that the concepts of race and whiteness have always meant less in Sweden and the other Nordic countries than in, for example, the English, the Portuguese, or the Spanish-speaking words, and that we are in no need of importing concepts that have little history and little relevance here in the Nordic region. And those who admitted that race actually played at least a certain part during the nation-building processes of the Nordic countries during the last century said that in spite of that, it is a good thing that the concept of race has now been abolished in Sweden, Finland, and Norway. On this slide, I think, the time is up soon. On this slide, I have tried to summarize the main arguments against race as I have understood them, as having been actively engaged with and involved in the debate on race, both within and outside the Swedish academia, during the past 10 years. The first argument, which one very often comes to hear, and perhaps particularly among left liberal, anti-racist and anti-fascist, and in the media, and in the cultural sphere in particular perhaps, as well as within academia, is that the concept of race itself is unscientific, as well as unethical, and even racist itself, and that this was proven after World War II, and at least after the end of the end of decolonization in the 1970s, and perhaps also the end of the civil rights movement in the US. The second argument, which perhaps is the one that is the most common among researchers, says that there is no need for the concept of race in the Nordic countries of today, as it is enough to focus on the migration aspect and on immigrants and foreign-born inhabitants, which are categorized according to their birth country. The third argument claims that the reintroduction of the concept of race will result in both the majority and the minority inhabitants becoming aware, suddenly aware of race, becoming race-conscious or even obsessed by race, as some would argue that we are nowadays obsessed by gender, right? It's in a way, the similar parallel argument for some, and which will also stigmatize the minorities even more, as the majority population will start to racialize them, and the minorities themselves will feel even more uncomfortable if their appearances and their bodies comes to the forefront. The fourth argument is more intra-academic and says that the concept of race, the concept of ethnicity is enough, as it also covers race, and which in a sense perhaps is true, since the concept of ethnicity was introduced as a kind of alternative to race at the end of the 1960s within Western academia, and that the terms of racialization and racism are preferred instead of the politically problematic, historically loaded, or even blood-soaked concept of race. And many researchers would also agree that the concept of whiteness is more accepted and palatable for them than the concept of race. On this slide, I have tried to summarize some of the principal arguments for reintroducing and researching race, and they are as follows. The first argument is that Sweden and the Nordic countries were historically strongly invested in race and whiteness during the modern nation-building processes that took place during the last century, and which has resulted in national identities such as Finnishness, Swedishness, Danishness, etc., that are still heavily loaded with ideas about race and whiteness. The fact that Sweden and the Nordic region, for example, harbor some of the Western world's more dynamic right-wing populist parties and nowadays also white supremacist movements might, for example, therefore not be a coincidence. The second argument says that Sweden and the Nordic countries are becoming rapidly and increasingly racially diverse on a demographic level, and an increasing proportion of the non-white inhabitants are today not immigrants anymore. And quite soon in the near future, the inhabitants with a non-Western background who are not foreign-born and who have not immigrated will actually supersede those who immigrated themselves in numbers. In Sweden, perhaps in 5 years, the so-called second generation, together with the mixed and the adopted, will probably constitute 50% of Sweden's inhabitants with a non-Western background. The third argument says that there are many indications showing that Sweden and the Nordic countries are today among the Western world's most segregated and stratified societies along racial lines, and that race even seems to trump class more and more in the Nordic region, although that is, of course, disputed. Finally, ethnicity does not always cover race, and the parallel would be that gender does not always cover sex. Migration is not always the only factor involved, and the terms racialization and racism are not always enough, as if gender studies would only make use of the terms genderization and sexism. And the concept of whiteness can only be used in relation to the concept of race, as these concepts are as related to each other as sex or gender and masculinity are. Finally, I want to end this presentation by also emphasizing that I'm very aware that what I've just said is mainly applicable to Sweden, as my presentation has been heavily focused on Sweden, and I apologize for that, of course, as I am in Finland now, and that both the pro and the counter arguments that I have summarized are perhaps also very Sweden-centered, and they might possibly sound differently in the other Nordic countries, including, of course, Finland, and that I don't know. However, it is my conviction that the concept of race is back now in the Nordic region as a whole, and not just in Sweden, whether we like it or not, and that it will be very difficult for the Nordic academia and for Nordic migration studies researchers to continue to avoid issues of race and whiteness in the future. This is regardless of whether the researcher is studying historically or contemporary Nordic race relations and race formations. We are, for example, not yet finished when it comes to studying Swedish and Nordic racial politics of the last century. On the contrary, I think we have just started to begin understanding how much race played a part in the Nordic region during the last century, which we just left behind. And as the Nordic countries become increasingly multiracial and heterogeneous, why they are at the moment at the same time are perhaps some of the Western world's most racially segregated and segmented societies, it is clear and obvious, at least to me, that Nordic critical race and whiteness studies has a bright future to look forward to. Yeah, that's everything.
Tobias, thank you so much for the exceptional keynote.
Yeah, thank you
very much. And I'd like to, on behalf of the ETMU, I would like to present you with this small, very modest Finnish token.
Yeah.
Of our only local coffee roaster in Finland. This is local coffee. But thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we have plenty of time for questions.
Oh, 10 minutes maybe, yeah.
Questions? Comments from the crowd?
Hi. Thanks for that. I was wondering if, like in other countries, there's a disparity in sort of segregation of academia in a way. Are the people studying anti-racism mostly white, or are they people of color themselves in Sweden? And does that affect how the term of race, for example, is being argued against?
Yeah, that's an important question. Those who are familiar with Swedish academia might know that is something that we took up a bit yesterday at the session, that there are probably statistically more researchers of color in Sweden than in any other Nordic country. And it is true that some of them, not all of them, but some of them have been the ones who have put forward and even introduced concepts such as racialization, intersectionality, whiteness, race, etc., or reintroduced it, depends on how we look upon it, in the Swedish context, but not all of them. And if I would think, I mean, your question is also, I mean, I think you basically also asked if it's the white or non-white researchers. There have, of course, also been white Swedish researchers who have been a part of that movement as well, but most of them have actually been researchers of color. If I would calculate or something, it probably,
Thank you, that was absolutely fascinating talk. I was wondering, you mentioned that in the 1960s, was it 1966, the Sweden's policies in terms of, for example, this anti-racism, they changed almost overnight. Could you say a little bit more about that, like how that, how did it happen so suddenly?
I don't know. It's a big mystery. It's, no one knows. It's there are, of course, those of us in Sweden who have our own hypothesis, and maybe they don't always come to the same conclusions. But I mean, my hypothesis, if I would market that, would be that I think what we today call the 68 revolution was extremely, but at least in Sweden, it had more with the racism and feminism. But of course, it had to do with that all over the West, right? These two kind of strands, or whatever you want to call them, ideologies that were resurrected at the time of the 68 revolution, where they played such a fundamental part in the Swedish case, to the extent that This was also the time when the Social Democrats still received more than 50% in the elections, and our biggest right-wing party had 15%. And what they did basically was that they managed to push the Social Democrat, the Socialist Labour Party, radicalize it basically, which led to all these policy changes in the 1970s. That's maybe like a surface explanation. The one that maybe I am more interested in is like the psychological or even psychoanalytical hypothesis. And now we come to speculations, of course, because nothing can be proven. But I think what happened among, let's call them the elites, and also the future elites, those who would then, start the 68 revolution, they were still young when they fought against the old academic elite. When it comes to the adoption debate, it's quite clear how the two camps were already like fighting even before 68. I think the younger ones, they had this idea about, they knew they were Swedes, of course, and they knew they were Scandinavians and Nordic people, and they lived in a country which was actually extremely white, although we had many, but the country had many immigrants in the 1960s, but almost all of them are from the Nordic countries. I think these avant-garde young people, they realized that a new world was being born out there in the third world, right? And that happened very rapidly, right? The decolonization process took place in barely 25 years, some people claim. One generation, basically, depending how you count, of course. It's a very complicated process, basically. How could this have happened, right?
Okay, the floor is
up there, then we have a question here, and then we have time.
Yeah, thank you. So in the middle of your very fascinating speech, you kind of skipped through this slide that was very interesting for me, where you were talking about the concept of race, because of course this is linguistically a very treacherous ground, and I think we have to be careful of kind of intuitive understandings of what we mean by race, because you know I would use it probably in a very different way than I don't know, US scholar or a neo-Nazi or so. Yes. Yeah, I'm very interested, and also in terms of, and that I still think that it is important that we avoid this reification of race as something, a biological category that is kind of predetermined. So, yeah. Was that the slide?
Yeah, well, the first one was too basic, so I'm a little bit ashamed about it, because we all know it, right? The history of ideas behind race. This one is more like what happened with the concept after 1945 and during the decolonization process, and especially after 1968. And this is basically what, most of us would agree with. I think it's quite neutral. So it more or less disappears in the Nordic region and among continental Europe, and in the East it's because of Marxism or communism, and in Western Europe there are other. It's a complicated story that is very generalized here or summarized here, but in the English-speaking world, we know that there's another trajectory, right? And so
okay,
that's the slide.
Oh, I'm sorry. Floor is here, and then we have one more question here, and then we, I think, have a coffee break.
Yeah, thank you for the presentation. So you made a connection between, or you showed us how the racial logic or racial thinking is involved in modern nation building. We know that story. So, but then you kind of end that story when after World War II, and it becomes more of a welfare state building project. So how do you see racial logics involved in welfare state building connected to concepts of equality and solidarity, as we talked about yesterday?
The Nordic welfare states, they are unique, as we all know, and we are very proud of that, because the Social Democrats took power in these countries on a democratic, through democratic elections. So it was an exceptional region in that sense compared to the rest of the world or the West. I unfortunately only know the Swedish case, right? Mm-hmm. And many would claim that the Swedish welfare state became the most advanced, and the only reason for that is, of course, because Sweden became the richest country among the Nordic countries after the war. So Sweden was able to create this. Yeah, if you come from the right, you would claim this extremely big welfare system, right? So anyway, I don't know if the welfare state. I don't know what you are up to. There are those who, including myself, who would say that the whole welfare state project, as it came about, and if you go to the, let's say, the foundational texts even before the welfare state existed in the 1970s, among special, both, I would claim, radical right-wing, today we would call them social conservatives or radical conservatives, some of us would call them fascists, and among radical Marxists in the left faction of the Socialist Democratic Party and even communists. These people, when they write about the welfare state as an idea in 1920s in Sweden, and perhaps also in the other Nordic countries, it is clear that there are... I took part in a session in Uppsala, actually, about this, where a friend of mine presented about this, exactly what you're asking about. So maybe I can just refer to him. So he basically claims that if you look at these foundational texts, there are three big issues, right, that has to be solved in Sweden. And I think this would go for Norway also, because both in Sweden and Norway and Sweden were bleeding. Hundreds of thousands of young adults left Sweden and Norway for the U.S. and the settler colonies. And this had been going on for almost 60 years in a row. And it was crazy, right? Those of us who are Norwegians and Swedes, we know this, right? That one out of three or one out of four, depending on how you count, and even higher proportions of the young adults, they just left because these countries were unbearable to live in. And that was one reason. So there was only one solution. Otherwise, the Swedish nation would die, biologically speaking. And the other one was about race. And it was connected to this huge mass emigration. When you look at these ideas about race in these texts, you will clearly see that they explicitly talk about these race hygienic measures, for example. One of the chief ideologies. There were many, but one of them was Gunnar Myrdal. He writes, there's a whole chapter about immigration. These are just his musings, right? This is way before the welfare state exists. But he talks about, our country is bleeding. The young people leave. We are in a bad state. We have to do something. And especially the working classes are leaving, right? The poor people, basically. What about immigration? Why not bring in others, right, from I don't know where? No, he says, that is not an option for us. And between the lines, it's about this idea that, we are so white, we are so homogeneous, and we belong to the Nordic race. Why would we do that? Instead, we should put the welfare state should do one of the main agendas of the welfare state is not to be obsessed by quantity, like France, like the UK, like the big Germany, the Soviet Union. They were obsessed by quantity, right? They wanted to increase their populations, right? Instead, we in Sweden should focus on quality. That is our future wealth. And we can do that by the way of the welfare state, because through the welfare state, we can... Yeah, not only make people stay, we can also make people, those we want to reproduce, and those who,
Okay, I would claim your keynote has started the discussion that would take about a couple hours at least to even do justice to, but the most unfortunate part of being a chair is letting everybody know it's time for a coffee break, but I would invite you to continue this really interesting conversation on the coffee break and thank our keynote presenter.